The gospel reading today is something we've already alluded to, and I'm going to move Totoro just a minute. The four spirits agree with us. We've alluded to in the children's time the story of the resurrection from Matthew's gospel. After the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary of Magdala came with Mary to inspect the tomb. And suddenly there was a severe earthquake, and an angel of God descended from heaven and rolled back the stone and sat on it. And the angel's appearance was like lightning, with garments white as snow. And the guards shook with fear and fell down as though they were dead. And the angel spoke, addressing the women, "Don't be afraid. I know you're looking for Jesus, the crucified, who is no longer here. Jesus has been raised, exactly as it was said. Come and see the burial place. Then go quickly and tell the disciples that Jesus has risen from the dead and now goes ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there. That is the message I have for you." And so the women hurried away from the tomb with awe and great joy and ran to carry the good news to the disciples. The word "good news" there is gospel. Suddenly Jesus stood before them and said, "Shalom." The women came up and embraced Jesus' feet and worshiped. And at this Jesus said to them, "Don't be afraid. Go tell the disciples to go to Galilee. They will see me there." I love Easter Sunday. I love preaching about Easter Sunday. The problem with it is that there's always just too much to say, and everybody's got things to do. But it's one of my favorite times of the year, and often I'm asked, for all the years I've been in ministry, whether they've been in America or in other places around the world, I've been asked the question, "So what do you think about the resurrection?" somewhere along the line at that place. And in Japan, I would say in Japanese, I am very invested in the resurrection of Jesus. And people would look at me and they would think, "He doesn't know the right word there, does he?" 私はイエス様の復活に信頼します。He meant to say 信じます, I'm sure. No, actually, I'm very invested in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's exactly what I meant. There's a great book, and I've referred to it before, which is interesting reading, even if you don't think that the heuristic is exactly right, by Stephen Fowler, called Stages of Faith. It's an old book. But if you think about stage one faith, which he says is characterized by the thinking of people age 3 to 7, they think of it, they think of things in an intuitive way. And so when told about the resurrection, they say things like, "Wow, look, Mom, I'm rising up." Or when they get a little older, ages 8 to 12, Fowler says, we move into a stage of mythic, literal faith. And when someone says, "Jesus rose from the dead," kids say things like, "Well, that's weird. How'd he do that? Maybe he's not one of us. Maybe he's like Superman or something. Oh, yeah, he was God, right?" And then there's stage 3 faith, which Fowler says is characterized by people as they come into a more rational way of thinking about the world, the early teen years, and sometimes this extends all the way up into adulthood. They start learning things from their parents and sort of drinking in the worldviews of those around them. And they think, "Well, it is hard to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but the church and the Bible say he rose from the dead, so obviously he must have risen from the dead." And some people stay there for a long, long time. But then there's stage 4 faith, which is called individuative reflective faith, and that's where people say, "Wait a minute, rose from the dead? Are you kidding me? Well, that's ridiculous. That's a bunch of hogwash. Why don't we dispense with all the superstition and get on with our lives?" And some people stay there. And then there's stage 5 faith, which Fowler calls conjunctive or integrative faith. And you might realize that fewer and fewer people are making it up this ladder as they go. But Fowler says this is where people start gaining a little respect for the wisdom of the tradition or the wisdom of the past, and simultaneously also a kind of a sense of poetry. And they say, resurrection, huh, yeah. I'm quite invested in the resurrection from the dead. That's good stuff. Of course, I wouldn't want to impose something like that, you know, kind of, that insight makes sense to me, but I wouldn't want to impose that on anybody else, you know. And then, Fowler says, is stage six faith, universalizing faith, he says. And the response there is, wow, look, I'm rising from the dead. Grab my hand and we'll go together. Christ is risen, the tradition say. We say Christ is risen, Latin, Christus resurrexit. If you listen to a lot of church music, it will be entitled Christus resurrexit, Christ has risen, or Christ is risen. But there's one tradition in the church that I like a lot, and that's the tradition that pulls its liturgy from the Vulgate, Romans chapter 6. And it's written right here in your bulletin. In Romans chapter 6, Paul writes a phrase that doesn't say Christus resurrexit. He says, Christus resurgens ex mortuis iam non moritur non illi ultra non dominabitur. Christ is rising from the dying. Christ is rising from the dying and can no longer die. And so death no longer rules. There's that tradition in the church that doesn't say Christ has risen, but says Christ is rising. And there's a great old Celtic chant from 1150, sometime if you go on the internet and just search it out. Christus resurgens, with the drums beating in the background and people walking around in circles as plants are coming up out of the ground at Easter time. Christ is rising. Oh, it's a cool song. You just got to listen to it. And as we mature spiritually, you know, we discover that the resurrection is not something that happened then and there to those people. It's good. Anywhere you're at on this journey is good. You can only be where you're at. Good for you. But I found out that as I have grown up myself and in my own spiritual journey, I've come to discover that it's not just something that happened then and there. 2,000 years ago, the death of Jesus and the resurrection as Christ is something that's happening everywhere. We don't need the Bible to teach us this. We see Christus resurgens, Christ rising in nature. We see it in our very lives. And the story of Jesus rising is the universal story, and that's why it rings true to so many of us and why it has stuck for 2,000 years. This Jesus who is invested in the world's needs and in the world's concerns. He wanted to see shalom, right relationship. He wanted to be part of a community guided by mutual compassion and therefore, of course, justice. He wanted the good. He wanted the good to rise. And the march to Jerusalem was his way of doing the truth-telling he knew needed must be done. His truth-telling to authority during that last week in Jerusalem was an attempt to call people back to first things, to strive for not just keeping the order going, but for restoring right relationship through changing the way that we treat one another, personally, socially, economically. But the powers didn't really care about those first things. It was not in their interest to care. And so Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane knowing that he's facing a moment of decision. He's going to keep speaking for the people and their needs, and he's going to probably be done away with. Or he's going to immerse himself in his own needs and figure this is the time to cut and run. His need for self-preservation, his need to be heard, his need to be respected, comes up against the call that extends to all of us to care for the greater good and not just for the self. And the story goes that for the Christ spirit to rise, the historical Jesus had to die. Jesus faced a choice to keep the axis of his existence inside of himself, or to shift the axis of his existence outside of himself and to suffer the loss and the pain and the darkness that that always entails. Anytime we move ourselves from the center and move that center somewhere else. He had to decide, am I going to fulfill my needs and my desires? Or am I going to risk living whatever life I have left for the needs and desires of God? A way of saying the needs and the desires of the whole, of the greater, of the more, of what is coming into being. He has to decide, will the world revolve around me and my crisis right now? Or will I revolve around the world and its crisis right now? The truth we all know is that the ego of Jesus had to die before the Christ spirit can arise, and that's what the story of the Garden of Gethsemane is about. The historic Jesus is the particular and the temporal agent in this crisis, but Christ is the universal and the eternal that rises. Jesus is the shalom embodied in a particular, unique, non-repeatable place and time, but Christ is the shalom embodied in the whole. Jesus marks a world of careful interbeing and the search for right relationship where he was and when he was. But Christ marks times working towards right relationship and that careful interbeing. And the truth is that the Christ spirit cannot arise when the self and its particular needs and desires is the axis of our being. That has to die before Christ can be rising. And this is the story of nature itself. Carrie and I were visiting Glacier last summer and taking wonderful pictures of barren stretches of wilderness with the husks, the old dead bodies of lodgepole pines staring us in the face. And we realized from the nature guide, this all had to die in order for the forest to be healthy. This is not something we don't know. As individuals and as a group, this is a truth that we know in our own experience. We don't need anybody else to tell us, but the story just reminds us of it again. Where this happens in us, when we let go of our personal fears and hang-ups and doubts and self-interest, and let whatever it is that we're holding on to die for the good of the whole, in that place, Jesus goes to the grave. And Christ is rising. That's good stuff. Irish monks, there was a story about Irish monks that they were asked sometime, how do you live a good life? They would fall to the ground and they would get back up. They would say, we go down to the earth and we get up again. we go down to the hummus and we get up again. That's how you live a good life. It's in letting go of the one for the sake of the many, for the sake of the whole, that lets the one rise up with the power of Christ, that lets the one rise up with the power of the eternal. We know this from just looking out at the world. I was reminded of a story last week about, I was rereading this Labor's Untold Story. Thanks for leading us in that discussion. Janet and David have been leading us in this discussion. Great story about the GM strike in 1936. Middle of the Depression. People needed work, but of course, somebody wanted to take advantage of the fact that people needed work. So the corporations were, and specifically GM, was doing speed up the line. Speed up the line, you get paid by the piece. Well, as soon as people got used to the speed up, they would lower the price per piece. They would work to try to speed up, to make as many pieces so that they could take home the same salary. And as soon as they got there, they'd lower the price per piece. People started getting tired. It was a hot summer in 1936, 100 degrees in the factory for many, many weeks. And people started dropping like flies. They were dying on factory floors. And people said, this has got to stop. We've got to come together. This has got to stop. So they started organizing themselves. They organized themselves and sat down in a plant in Atlanta. They all sat down in a plant in Kansas City. They sat down in Cleveland. They sat down in Detroit, Michigan, and Pontiac, and Flint, and Dearborn, and Anderson, Indiana, and Norwood, Ohio. They just sat there. And they said, what are you going to do about this? They sat there for 30 days. People were bringing in food to the workers, trying to keep them alive. The families were bringing in food, trying to get through the lines. People in the city who had been engineered to think that this was some sort of Sovietization of the United States were protesting outside, trying to keep food from getting in. At one point, the governor of Michigan decides that after the corporate leaders told him he needs to uphold the law and preserve their private property, he needed to use force. He is getting ready to send in troops. The women were tear gassed. Machine guns were fired into crowds to try to disperse them. They held. On the 42nd day, the mayor was meeting with the leader of the union and said, tomorrow we're coming in and we're going to blow you all out of these factories unless you leave. And the leader of the union said, tomorrow morning, you look in the second floor window of that factory. I'm going to open that window. I'm going to take off my shirt. And the first bullet you let go of needs to hit me. And when you see me fall, you think about what you're doing. Guess who caved? They won that strike. And it was the beginning of a number of sit-downs around the country in the Depression, which people's wages were raised because people were realizing, listen, it takes me dying to self-interest, dying to my petty concerns, and moving the axis out of my center in order for the greater good to be done. And you know what? When I do that, I am free, and Christ is rising. And it's painful and scary to be in a position like that. Socially, that's true. Think of Martin Luther King Jr., who the night before he was shot gave an address at the Masons Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, that famous I've been to the mountaintop speech on April 3rd. Well, I don't know what will happen now, he said. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. And I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight, and I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man, for mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Christ rising, right? How could you not like that? And in our personal lives, it's the very same thing. In our personal lives, we make a sad mistake when we adults think that Easter is only a remembrance of that time, then, and there. For in truth, Easter is about us right now, and it's about the choices we face to live in the axis of the self and its needs, and not to die, and not to rise, or to live around the axis of the world, and to embrace the loss that we will feel and the pain that we will know for the sake of the world and for the sake of seeing Christ rising. In the first church I ever pastored, and I'll be done, there was a couple named Richard and Linda Smith, working class family, very modest means, who couldn't have a child of their own. They decided to adopt a little girl. They took Samantha into their home as an infant, and in a few months they knew something was wrong. Didn't know what it was. And through a series of tests, they came to understand that their daughter, Samantha, whom they adopted, had a rare disease that made her age faster than anyone else. And that disease was going to remove from her the use of her limbs. She was going to be immobile. And they had to make the decision about whether they were going to keep her After a year of her being in their family, or they were going to take her back and put her into some sort of care situation. And I remember them telling me about this as I knew them when Samantha was about 10 years old and confined to a wheelchair, unable to speak to anyone, but could nod her head and can move her arms just a little bit. They decided to keep her. And I had many, many dinners and times of meeting with Richard and Linda in which they would tell me the difficulties they faced day by day just trying to make it with Samantha in their home. How difficult it was to raise a family and to find the money that was necessary to keep her alive and to keep her happy and doing all the things that she could do. And when Samantha was 12 years old, she passed away. Funeral was at our church. And I remember something that Richard and Linda said to me that I will never forget. They said, "We could not cure Samantha, and we could not keep her here either, but Samantha cured us. And after 13 years now, we have somehow been saved." They were different because they knew how to see their lives and others in a completely different way. They had suffered great loss because they had moved the axis of their beings outside of themselves to serve a greater good. But they had been saved. And since then, there have been many sources, they have been sources of salvation to many, many people. And sometimes when I know of people who have children in similar situations, I will ask them to call Richard and Linda just so that they can talk. They are a balm of Gilead. They are part of the world's coming into healing and coming into peace. They gave themselves over to doing what the cosmos wanted done for good to rise. Jesus dies, but the truth is that when Jesus dies, Christ is rising, and death no longer rules. Wow. Look, I'm rising from the dead. Quick, grab my hand. We'll go together. Let's pray. Oh God, we thank you for resurrection. And as odd as it seems, help us also to be thankful for the grave. We ask this in humility, relying upon your strength and the strength of those through whom you live. Amen.